I said last time that this blessing had its content changed when the temple was destroyed. While the temple was standing, we weren't praying for the rebuilding of the temple, obviously. But let's see what it says now. Ritzei, it's be favorable. Ritzei means to accept in favor. Someone offers you something, and you accept it favorably, if you're willing to receive it as a gift, that's Ritzei. That word is used with sacrifices all the time. So, we are expressing the idea that I mentioned to you last time, that the prayer is a sacrifice of the person to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And here we say, please accept in favor your people Israel and their prayer. When the temple was standing, here we would have said, accept the offering of the temple. Instead of that, what we say is, please return the service to your Holy of Holies. Now, in your text here, there's a period. And then it goes on. The fire offerings of Israel and their prayer accept with love and favor. Now, what's that? We're asking that it be accepted now. We don't have any fire offerings now. And the truth is that syntactically, this is ambiguous. You don't have to put a period where the where your translator puts a period. You could have read it like this. Restore the service to the Holy of Holies of your temple and the fire offerings of Israel. There's an end there. Semicolon. Restore the service and the fire offerings. Semicolon. That's talking about what we'd like to happen, not what has happened. And then you say, and their prayer you should receive in favor even now. So in terms of where we're standing and what we're able to do, that would be a much easier way to punctuate it. The truth is the commentators take it both ways. What does it mean if it's punctuated the way you have it here in the Siddur? So on the bottom, in the commentary, it gives two explanations. The souls and the deeds of the righteous, which are as pleasing as the sacrifices. If they see Jewish prayers and like offerings, that's a little difficult because the next word is their prayer. So it would be quite kind of redundant. You see at the end of this, somebody punctuate the blessing to read. Unfortunately, there is a very literal application of this. As we know from last Thursday, these Jews who are killed and who often are burned by enemies, and they too can be regarded as offerings or sacrifices. And we're asking that they should be accepted in faith. At any rate, when a person says this, if he's aware of it, he thinks of it as ambiguous. Either the burnt offering is visible with the previous, or it goes with the succeeding. And both are correct. And then it says, let the service of the children of Israel be always favorable to you. That means with a temple or without a temple. Our ability to serve God does not end because we don't have a temple. It's very much reduced. Out of the 613 commandments, at present, about 250 are we are able to perform. The majority we cannot perform under present conditions. Still, we are able to serve God. And we are asking that that service be acceptable. And then we repeat, but let our eyes see you return to Zion in mercy. Don't anyone think that the service we are able to do now is satisfactory and we are content with it. Nope, it's only a minimal stand-in for what the entire service should have been. Okay? Now we come to Moses. And here we have a problem. If you translate the way the Brown Book does, it says, "We shall gratefully thank you." And 5 lines later, it says, "We shall thank you and relate your praise," etc. You don't have to do that. Modim in Hebrew is ambiguous. It can mean to thank, and it can mean to acknowledge, to affirm, to assert, to recognize. You often have disputes in the Mishnah between Basil and Shammai, and often enough, Basil gives in. And the phraseology is Modim Basil Veshammai. Doesn't mean that they're expressing their gratitude. It means that having disagreed with them, they now change their minds and have decided to agree with them. In Hebrew, in the noun form, there's a subtle distinction. Hodoyo means thanksgiving. Hodo'o means acknowledgement or assertion. Be very careful when you see a noun based on that verb to understand what it means. Indeed, Maimonides, in the Laws of Blessings, says that all blessings can be divided into 3 categories. Blessings on commandments. Asher tibishadu b'mitzosof, mitzivonu, it's commanded us to do XYZ. Blessings on enjoyment, food, drink, and smell. And blessings of hodo'o. And then he says the blessings of hodo'o subdivide into 3 types. One is praise, one is thanksgiving, and one is hodoyo. I actually saw a translation into English which translated both hodo'o and hodoyo as thanksgiving. That makes the Rambam incoherent. The supercategory is thanksgiving, and there are 3 subcategories. Thanks, praise, petition, and thanks. Then the supercategory and subcategory are identical, which is ridiculous. That's not what the Rambam means. The Rambam means that the supercategory is assertion or acknowledgement. And then there are 3 types of assertion or acknowledgement. Praise, petition, and thanksgiving. And what the Rambam means is this. In those 3 subcategories, praising God, thanking God, and asking from God, each of those 3 is based on a fact. The blessing acknowledges the fact and then expresses our attitude towards the fact, or our reaction to the fact. There are 2 things going on. If anybody studies philosophy and knows speech act theory, definitely is relevant here. There are 2 things going on. First is the acknowledgement of a fact, and then there's the expression of our attitude towards the fact. Let's take a look. Praise. What fact is praise built on? I spoke about this last week a couple of times. If you praise something, then the fact that triggers your praise is the fact that the thing you're praising is great. It's great. It's outstanding.
And as I argued last week, that's a fact. It's an objective fact. You can get that right or get it wrong.
Now, what attitude do I have towards this great thing? Am I irritated by it? Am I threatened by it? Am I challenged by it? If I praise, then I'm expressing the response of being in awe, which isn't necessary. It doesn't have to be a response. So praise starts with the fact of the greatness of the thing I'm praising and expresses my reaction to the fact. What about Thanksgiving? What fact is Thanksgiving based on? So it's obvious, right? I receive something good. Again, if I receive something good, my reaction doesn't have to be gratitude. Sometimes a person does you a favor and you suspect that he's doing you the favor in order to belittle you. If you don't express gratitude, you express anger. So, gratitude starts with the fact that you receive something good and it expresses a particular reaction, the reaction of gratitude. How about petition? Petition rests on two facts, namely, I need it and he's got it. That's why I ask for something. Because I need it or I want it and he's got it. Now, requesting it, again, it's not necessary. There could be lots of different responses to the fact that I need it and he's got it. I could eat myself up because I don't have it. Someone else, under those conditions, could try to steal it. I mean, requesting it is one of the possible responses to those two facts. So the Rambam says, when you think about petition, praise, or thanksgiving, recognize that all of them start with certain facts, and then express our responses to those facts. And the Rambam says, this category, the category of hodah, category of acknowledgement, was created by the rabbis in order to be mindful of God continuously. That's why they created these blessings. Because the facts which trigger these responses are facts that you run into quite often. And they're facts which have an impression on you. They're facts which you experience with some emotion. So the rabbi says, when you have such an experience that's meaningful to you, use it as a bridge to relate to God. And that's why they created these blessings. I'm saying this because the whole of the Shemona Esrei, which is what we are studying, is divided between praise, petition, and thanksgiving. That's what the blessings are. The first three blessings are praise, the intermediary blessings are petition. Now we're coming to the blessing of that's focused on thanksgiving. So, since thanksgiving, according to the Rambam, is one of those three two-dimensional activities, it starts with an acknowledgement, and then it continues with an expression of gratitude. Okay, with me so far? So the first modim, I would suggest, should be translated, we acknowledge to you that you are. And then afterwards it goes into, we shall thank you. Now, the things that we acknowledge are standing facts, which are general. They're general and universal for everyone. And then the things we express gratitude for are matters that will vary from person to person. We acknowledge you that you are Hashem, our God and God of our forefathers for all eternity, rock of our lives, shield of our salvation, or even generation to generation. Preserve the Jewish people as a whole. We shall thank you and relate your praise for our lives,
which are committed to your power, our souls which are entrusted to you, and now it's person by person. Each person's life is cared for and organized by God in a different way. For your miracles are with us every day, your wonders and favors in every season, evening, morning, and afternoon. Now let's see if anybody remembers what I told you some time ago. What does it mean, miracles that are with us every day, wonders and favors every season, evening, morning, and afternoon? We experience miracles all the time, every day, evening, morning, and afternoon. What kind of miracles is he talking about?
Life is a miracle. Everything's a miracle.
Everything's a miracle. Everything's a miracle. Let's see. On Hanukkah and Purim, there's a special blessing that you make. She'osa nisim la'avoseinu v'yamim v'hein v'zman hazeh. That God did miracles for our ancestors in those days at this time. Miracles of Hanukkah, miracles of Purim. I guess if we make those blessings that blessing at those times, and we don't make it at other times, then there's something special about those times. But what seems to be special is that we say he did miracles.
This is the law of the miracles. I guess the bombing is
what's that say again?
The bombing that just happened on Thursday.
Yes.
The 100 miracles that happened, someone was supposed to get on the bus, someone didn't get on the bus, someone got off the bus. 100 miracles. Someone was on the bus, didn't get hurt. So those kind of miracles. Then you have the fact that, I don't know, someone came into class today, it was a miracle, you did not go to class.
So let's define the difference. What is the difference between the special type of miracle that we make this blessing for on Purim and Hanukkah and on Pesach? And the rest of the time, the other miracles that we don't make this blessing for. By the way, in Shulchan Aruch it says, if a miracle happened to you in a certain spot, every time you go past that spot in the future, you have to make a blessing to God that he did a miracle for you in that spot. So you were riding your motorcycle down the mountain road, and all of a sudden a truck loomed up in front of you, couldn't get out of the way, did a somersault, the bike went over the cliff, and you were caught on a tree branch by the back of your shirt. You held there for 15 minutes until it came and took you out. It was a 300-foot drop. Every time you go past that spot on the road, you should make this blessing. Right? But not every time you go past a water fountain where you drank some water, even though, it seems, drinking the water is also a miracle. So as you say, there must be different levels of miracle here. So what's the difference between one level and the other level? Okay, so this is one way to do it, to talk about revealed miracles and hidden miracles. That's fine. Let's just finish it. What then is a miracle? If drinking a glass of water is also a miracle, and the difference between that and Purim is revealed, and drinking a glass of water is hidden, so what does the word miracle mean? I'm not challenging you. You're right. But let's say, we just need to finish it. We need the definition of the word miracle now. So here, the word miracle means an event that is brought about directly by God. An event that is brought about directly by God. Not that God is on vacation and created nature and let nature run by itself. No. The event is brought about directly by God. Now, it's that definition of miracle which enables someone to say, your miracles surround us, they're with us every day, evening, morning, and afternoon, because we don't believe in nature at all, not as a thing in and of itself, a thing that operates on its own. Nature, as you indicated with your words, nature is just where God's will repeats itself in certain categories. An open miracle is where God's will doesn't repeat itself in those categories. So if by miracle we mean
an event that's brought about directly by God, then we can say every event is a miracle, excepting perhaps free will. But aside from that, every event that happens in the world is a miracle, and we're surrounded by miracles continuously. And the blessings that we make are for the open, revealed miracles, not for the hidden miracles. And that is one correct way to use the word and to explain the ideas. Everybody living up to here? I just want you to know, just to make things confusing, that in some writers, in our sources, the word miracle is used for what we just called an open miracle. And then, the only thing they call a miracle is where God shows his agency. The rest are not called miracles. They don't use the word miracle that way. But the underlying picture is the same in all cases. The underlying picture is that God is producing. Some things he produces according to patterns, and some things he doesn't produce according to patterns. Yeah?
It seems like some of the discussion of miracles also defines it as things that we acknowledge as being good as well. For example, you brought up the bus bombing, and you brought up an example of somebody who didn't get on the bus. But if everything is a miracle, and an open miracle is that which is not a pattern, meaning it doesn't happen all the time, I would say a bus bombing kind of falls under that category, then the bus bombing itself was a miracle.
Well, unfortunately, bus bombings and suicide bombings, I don't think anybody regards as an open miracle. They happen much too often, and they also happen in Kashmir, and they happen in Bali, and they happen, you know, in other places in Baghdad, and they have, you know, it's not as if it's so openly against all the course of human nature. But I don't think it's restricted to things that you would acknowledge as good, or at least at the moment. Miracles were done for our enemies when they were attacking us, and we suffered from that. So I don't think we would define that as good. No, but I think one little qualification does need to be made. A miracle, I said it before, but it has to be stressed. A miracle is an event that shows God's agency. It's not just any odd, peculiar, one-in-a-shot event. Some people have been hypnotized by scientism, which is one another religion, to think that, of course, everything has a natural cause. So there has to be something that doesn't have a natural cause. Because as far as nature is concerned, everything has a natural cause. But that's absurd. What we have learned from quantum mechanics is that on the micro level, there are many, many events with no natural cause whatsoever. And you can easily hook up a macro event to a micro event. Just take a radioactive atom. When it disintegrates, it's not caused by anything, according to quantum mechanics. It just pops off when it feels like it. Now, attach a Geiger counter to that, and attach a bomb to the Geiger counter. So when the bomb goes off, it's not triggered by any cause whatsoever. Now, in principle, once you have that category in your scientific picture of the world, in principle, macro events might happen for no reason also. You know? They might materialize in the middle of the table there, a snail, and crawl around for 2 minutes and just disappear. There's no reason why the universe couldn't be that way. So far, we haven't observed it to be that way, but it doesn't mean it couldn't be that way. That wouldn't be a miracle. The fact that it has no cause, it has no natural explanation, just the universe is a little nutty, you know, just from time to time pops off and does things for no reason whatsoever. That would not be a miracle by our definition. A miracle has to express God's agency. So it has to serve God's purposes. But with that qualification, that's what we'll call a miracle or open miracle. And the rest of what happens are events which you don't see God's agency in. But God's agency, in fact, is there. You with me so far? Okay. Now comes something which is very deep, and which I think people don't pay careful enough attention to. It says, The beneficent one?
Oh, boy. What does that mean?
Is there a clue what beneficent means?
Well, it means good. Okay?
Give you a little simple one-syllable shot at it. That's what it says in Hebrew. The good one, for your mercies are never exhausted, and the merciful one, for your kindnesses are never ended. Now, goodness and kindness are roughly the same thing. See, here's what it says. You're the good one because your mercies didn't run out, and you're the merciful one because your goodness didn't run out. Isn't that scratching your left ear with your right arm, with your right hand? You know, why cross categories like that? Why not say, you're the good one because your goodness didn't run out, and you're the merciful one because your mercy didn't run out? No. You're the good one because your mercy didn't run out, and you're the merciful one because your goodness didn't run out. What does it tell you? I think something very deep is going on here. I'll give you some of it. To do the whole background would take an hour or more. Let's think what the difference is between goodness and mercy. Goodness, kindness, and mercy. There's an enormous difference. Goodness can be a motivation to act all by itself. One who gives can give out of the fact that he is a good person. He gives because he's a kind person. He sees that you need, he sees that you'll benefit, and he gives to you. Mercy is not like that. Mercy starts with a negative. Mercy is always working against justice. Justice says someone should get hurt. Mercy says don't. Don't do justice. Give them a break. Mercy is always a plea against justice. This is a very important implication. Mercy always needs a reason. You always need a reason. Okay. First quiz of the day. Why does it need a reason? I just told you. It's saying no. There's already a reason for the person to get hurt. There's already a reason on the table. Justice. Mercy says no. No, you can't just say no. You have a reason. There's a reason for yes, and you're saying no. So explain why. Why it's appropriate not to do what justice says. That's why a plea for mercy always says, if he goes to prison, he'll become a worse criminal, and his parents and family will take care of him, and they'll work into rehabilitation, and he's a first-time offender, and he has a good record, and he has enough money to go undergo rehabilitation. There's always a whole list of reasons why the plea of mercy is supposed to be justified. Whereas, if the motivation is goodness or kindness, it doesn't need a justification. The goodness or kindness is its own justification.
If mercy is going against justice, then you have a reason. Like, if you justify it, it doesn't make any justice. How are you going against justice?
That's good for poetry, but it's not good for philosophy. There's a difference between justice and justified. You can be justified to do something which is not justice. Justified is a much more broad term. Justified means there's roughly an adequate reason to do it. Justice is one type of reason, but only one type of reason.
Can't like justice like within like a justice system, can't there be like, can it be based on like acceptance, and when those acceptance comes up, it's still
that? This now is semantics. I don't mind. If a person wants to talk that way, he can talk that way, but it's useful to have a distinction between what the law requires. Let's put it this way. Imagine the difference between when the legal decision is handed down, right? He's guilty and this is the punishment. Imagine the difference between claiming that the decision was unjust and thereby objecting, or claiming that it's unmerciful and objecting. If you claim it's unjust, you're claiming victimization. You're claiming that the judge should go to jail. Somebody's rights were trampled. They didn't use due process. The witnesses weren't cross-examined correctly. Something went wrong. Right? A plea for mercy isn't like that. A plea for mercy doesn't say something went wrong. If the judge says, no, I reject your plea for mercy, and I'm going strictly according to the law, he hasn't done anything wrong. A plea for mercy doesn't accuse the judge of making a mistake, a legal mistake. It says, here, the legalities don't take into account the total human situation.
That is so
the human being and society would be better served if you don't stick with the strict legalities of the crime and the punishment. Now, the legal system may make room for this, and indeed it does make room for this. Otherwise, the plea for mercy wouldn't be relevant. But there's a big difference between mounting a defense and saying he didn't commit the crime, or he did it in self-defense, he had a reason for doing it, an excuse for doing it, or you didn't follow due process, where you're challenging the verdict. Versus a plea for mercy, which says the verdict is correct. I acknowledge the verdict is correct. But I don't want the sentence carried out anyhow. Because both justice and mercy, this is what I'm coming to, so I'm not coming down to the back door. Both justice and mercy are expressions of a higher principle. If you thought that God has certain principles that he operates by, and each principle is separate, distinct, and absolute, then you would have an open contradiction, just as you understood it, as you expressed now. How can he be both just and merciful? There's a contradiction between them. The answer is they aren't independent, absolute principles. They're both expressions of a higher principle. Now, that's what I want to explain now. I'll explain it now. You'll see the answer to your question as well. Okay, so I've explained to you now how goodness on the one hand, goodness, kindness on the one hand, and mercy on the other hand, are different from one another. But now look how they're related. When you do charity, there are different levels of charity, different types of charity. But in Jewish law, the highest form of charity, the most complete, perfect form of charity is?
Give someone a job.
Give someone a job. Why is that the most perfect form of charity? Why is it better, for example, than anonymous charity, which is next to best?
So you're teaching them how to fish.
For a steady diet of bass. Okay, what good is it to teach them how to fish? I mean, your answer is right. You know it's right, but I want more than that.
You give them independence.
You give them independence. Good. And what, let's take it one step further. What difference does it make whether you give independence or not?
Self-satisfaction.
Oh, how does he feel about it? He feels a sense of accomplishment. He feels a sense of worth. He feels a sense of dignity. Whereas if you give him and he doesn't work for it, then he feels that he's dependent. He feels that he's a failure. Here, this sounds extreme. Imagine you're standing at a red light, waiting to walk across the street, and next to you is a bundle that you're carrying. You put it down. The bundle weighs 25 pounds. Someone comes over to you and says, oh, it looks like you have a heavy bundle there. I'll carry it across the street for you. What would you say? Thanks very much, but it's really not that heavy. Only 25 pounds. I can manage 25 pounds. If it were 75 pounds, maybe you'd ask me, you'd appreciate some help, but not with 25 pounds. Why not? You'll get across the street without having to carry it. You save yourself a little effort. Oh, but it's insulting. Why are you offering to carry a 25-pound package for me? I can manage that myself. I don't need your help for that. If he helps me for that, he's treating me like a cripple. I don't want to be treated like a cripple. I want my independence and my strength to be acknowledged. Okay, so the idea of charity, the best charity, is to give a person a job. Notice, by the way, that when you give somebody money, and let's say you give it person to person, there's an embarrassment. He's embarrassed to receive it, and he'll be embarrassed to see you. That's why usually you want the charity to be anonymous, because you don't want that person to be embarrassed. Now, look how beautiful giving a job is. Here, the giver and the recipient know each other, and there's no embarrassment. It's amazing. Receiving a job is a very precious gift. Ask people who are out of work. How terrible it is to be out of work. And still, when they get a job, they don't feel embarrassed with respect to the person who gave them the job. Because the money they get at the end of the week, they earned. Okay? Now, that's what charity would be when it's ideal. What motivates this charity? What characteristic in the giver? This is goodness. This is kindness. The person doesn't deserve the job. He has no claim on the job. He has no right to the job. You give him the job out of your goodness. Right? But now that you've given him the job, how do you pay him? You pay him according to the contract. Contract says 40 hours a week, $2,000 a week. What characteristic are you expressing when at the end of the week you take out the contract, you take out the supervisor's report, and you pay him X number of dollars per hour? How are you interacting with him? You're interacting with him on the basis of strict justice. You earned it, you get it. You didn't earn it, you don't get it. The most profound form of kindness is to set up a justice relationship with somebody. So that what he gets in the end is something that he earned. Now, imagine setting up that relationship with somebody who's out of work, 40 hours a week, $2,000 a week, comes in at the end, first Friday, supervisor says he worked 25 hours. Next week, 18 hours. Next week, 23 hours. So you pay him half salary. After a few weeks, social worker comes in and says, listen, maybe you didn't appreciate it, but the person that you took for this job is in the middle of detoxification, is kicking a drug habit. And he dropped out of school at the age of 15, so his literacy is very difficult, and when you give him instructions, he has to go home at night and study them because he can't have. And he just can't do more than 20 hours a week. He's not able to do 20 more hours a week. And on the salary you're paying him, he can't live. So the social worker says, I'm asking you to give him more money, even though he isn't working the extra hours, because he can't. Now, when I give him the extra money, that's not justice anymore. That's not justice anymore. That's mercy. Because the social worker says, and has a justification for the uphill battle, yes, you signed the contract. And you signed the contract out of the most profound kindness. Because you wanted to give him the most perfect gift. The gift of support plus self-respect, dignity, independence. But he can't have it. He can't handle it. So now your choice is support him so that he can survive or not. So then I say, well, I'd rather have him survive. I don't want him to fail. So he'll earn half, and the other half will be a free gift. And the free gift will carry with it a measure of embarrassment. But it's better that he should survive. Especially if he's in the process of improving himself. A year from now, or 2 years from now, he'll be able to handle a full-time job. So here's where mercy modifies the application of strict justice. Okay, now, the last point. Who's speaking for the social worker? The social worker is asking for mercy. Yes. To what characteristic is the social worker appealing when he asks for mercy? Give me mercy for my client because you are? Because you're good. Right. Because you're good. It's another appeal to the top. Mercy is really goodness second time round. This is my idea now, so that means I can't testify that it's surely right. If I'd read it someplace, I'd be much more happy with it. But this is the way I understand it. Mercy is goodness second time round. Goodness first time round sets up a relationship of strict justice. Because that's the highest quality goodness. Goodness second time round recognizes mercy to modify the justice so as to spread the benefits as widely as possible. Now look what it says in the Siddur. What it says in the Siddur now I think is gold. Because it says that each one is dependent upon the other. You're the good one because your mercies are never exhausted. Your goodness doesn't stop first time round. Your goodness goes second time round also. And that's why the mercies are never ending. Goodness applies even second time. That's how good you are. And you're the merciful one. Where does mercy come from? Mercy doesn't come from some other source. There isn't an inherent source against justice. It comes because you are good and kind, and that's where justice comes from in the first place. Mercy is an application of goodness. So this is the same fact looked at from both sides. Goodness extends itself even to mercy. Mercy has its source in goodness. Because mercy is good the second time around. If you don't say something like that, then I think these words become poetry without real meaning. Questions?
There's a need to be seen from two perspectives. Isn't it implicit? Because you're good, mercy comes from that.
Yeah, but not necessarily all mercy. Mercy, there might be two types of mercy. Mercy coming from two sources.
Example?
I don't need an example. The point is, theoretically, if I say that a good person whose goodness is unlimited will extend mercy, good. So I know that he will extend mercy. But now if I see mercy is in operation, how do I know the mercies all come from there? He will extend mercy, and maybe his mercy also comes from someplace else. How do I know all mercy comes from there?
You mean as far as the motivation is concerned?
Yeah, there's going to be other divine principles that also should contribute mercy. That's a theoretical possibility. He says no. It's not like that. Okay, I can't resist one little thing here. You have the motive of the rabbis, which is really the combining three different statements of three different rabbis. There's a whole thing, which I'm not going to do in detail. But the reason I want to read it to you, or part of it to you, is because this is our charter for Zionism. If anybody asks you, what is the religious position of Zionism? Here it is, in a few lines. In the middle of the great paragraph, so may you continue to give us life and sustain us and gather our exiles to the courtyards of your sanctuary, to observe your decrees, to do your will, and to serve you wholeheartedly. There it is. Zionism in black and white. Bring us back to the land so that we can observe your decrees, do your will, and serve your wholeheartedly. That is the sum total of Zionism. Anything else has nothing to do with us. Okay. And then the paragraph ends. Always we have put our hope in you. May Olam. In other words, continuously going all the way back to the beginning. We put our hope in you. So what? Why is there a dash there in the English? How does it fit into the rest of the paragraph? The paragraph started with acknowledgement. And then it said, it went to thanks, to thanks and praise. You provide everything for us. You surround us with your wonders and favors every evergreen. You treat us with kindness and with compassion, with goodness. Could be to a certain extent. Yeah, sorry.
Could it be that because we shouldn't take it for granted that these mercies and goodness will continue for us as they have always, and that our hope is that it will continue in our prayer?
We certainly shouldn't take it for granted, and we certainly should pray for these things. Here, we're stating them as facts, and then we say, we are stating them as facts relating to us. We speak about here the Jewish people and our lives. We're surrounded. Could be a matter of proportionality here. Those who trust in God, those who hope to God, and those who show it will be more benefited by God in these ways, on the whole, than those who do not. God has an investment to make in those who trusted Him. So, this fact that God does surround us in this way is related to the fact that we have always put our trust in Him. There's a verse, the Talmud comments in an almost shocking way. The verse says, Atem Eidai, you are my witnesses, God says to the Jewish people. You are my witnesses. You know what it says? When you are one of my witnesses, I am. And when you're not my witnesses, I am not. Whatever that means. It means that God's, so to speak, reputation in the world depends upon our condition. People read God's relationship to the world by our condition. If we trust in Him, if we put our hope in Him, and then He favors us in these ways, then it is publicized that those who hope in Him have favor. And that way, God's existence and God's principles are publicized. If we're in a position where we hope in Him less, or trust in Him less, so then He doesn't have that testimony in the favor that He bestows upon us, and that motivation to show us favor is lacking. Yeah.
When we trust Him in less, does that mean I would say that there's still an element of mercy there?
Well, remember what we said. Mercy needs a justification. Mercy needs a reason. Mercy is always don't do justice because. There has to be a because. So if the fact that we trust in Him and hope to Him, that could be a reason. If there's less of that, then there's less reason. There's less reason, less claim on mercy. Mercy needs a justification.